You only have to look at ancient art and writings to know that among human beings, same-sex attraction has existed across time and cultures. Even in the animal kingdom, you'll see beasts of all shapes and sizes acting like they're ready to march in a gay pride parade.
But in our culture, studying homosexuality comes with a lot of political and religious baggage, so it's difficult making sense of why so many of us are gay.
Today, science journalist Vince Gabriel joins us to take a look at the sexy science of homosexuality.
All the popular studies, some successful and some far-fetched, that scientists have done over the past 60 years to try to understand what makes us gay.
Plus, the gay best friend archetype and the dangers of eugenics.
Gay genes, gay brains, gay lions, and strong lizards that don't need no damn man.
I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun.
Today's Feast of Fun podcast is made available free to the public without any commercial interruption. Please consider making a donation at feastoffun.com/donate or become a paid subscriber at feastoffun.com/plus to support this podcast you love.
Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. She blinded me with science.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, is this Vincent Gabriel?
Speaking.
Hi, Vincent. It's Fausto.
And Mark from Feast of Fun. How are you doing today?
Oh, I'm doing pretty well today. I just got off, 2.5 mile hike down an incredibly steep mountain.
You're feeling your oats.
Yeah, and I'm feeling my feet.
Your biological exuberance.
That's one word for it.
Are you familiar with the book Biological Exuberance?
No, I'm actually not.
It's fascinating. But it basically explores homosexuality in the animal kingdom. From lizards to lions to gay penguins and flamingos. Mm. All those animals getting it on, honey.
I imagine we're talking about, domesticated sheep?
And domesticated sheep. The gayest of animals of them all.
And pigs. Everybody. They're all doing it.
But the sheep, right? The sheep are the gayest of all the animals.
I don't know. Rabbits, too. Because they even in China, they have their gay god is a rabbit god. Because the Asians feel that rabbits are naturally homosexual animals.
I mean, if you've talked to a rabbit, you'd know they're pretty gay. Mm.
But according to people who study this, the field of animals and mm-hmm. getting on and being gay, the sheep stand apart in that they're like us, which they'll pair off or they'll go gay. They'll only have sex with men. And that's it. Like other animals, like the male lions. And there's tons of gay male lion porn on YouTube because it's legal. Because you can watch animals having sex, you can't watch humans having sex.
I shudder to think of what happens when, Mark comes home and, the YouTube is on and you're just like, it's for research.
He's like, wah.
But you go on YouTube and just type in, gay pride, and you'll find...
Gay lion pride.
Gay lion pride.
There's actually a t-shirt of that, you know? It's just a bunch of maned lions in a pink background.
Mm-hmm. I've seen.
And so it's footage of people go on these safaris, you know, they go look at lions and they find out that lions, you know, with their manes, there's very clear that it's dudes. They're all like humping each other. Yeah. And it's not necessarily like dominance over one over the other, but because they're just like to have sex with each other.
Well, that's the other thing, too, is like if I understand correctly with lion prides is they have one lion who's like the king of the pride, then they all these females, and on the outskirts or on the periphery are all these solitary males.
Yeah.
And you know,
it's not safe to be a solitary lion on the savannah. It's better if you pair up with a bunch of other lions. So it's sort of this interesting situational constructed family thing that the lions are doing as a matter of like them being social animals and needing each other, but also, you know, it's hard when you're a young lion and all the giant male lions have like corralled all the female prides.
Yeah, they get lonely.
Oh, so it's them sort of like keeping each other company because they're missing out on the sweet, sweet, delicious female lioness love. And so they're prison gays, basically?
Well, not quite. I mean, it's also that they need to have a tribe in order to be, you know, successful. I mean, imagine being a lonely lion and like having to face down a pack of hyenas, it's not the best scenario for making sure you're fed.
Yeah, and those hyenas, those female hyenas, have fake penises.
Yeah, that's another episode. We'll get to that. So I want to position this as I was combing YouTube, as we usually do, trying to find...
Looking for lion porn.
Well, looking for fun things and interesting things to share on the podcast Feast of Fun, because it's a collection of interesting people and ideas that we discover on the internet. And what inspired today's show was a TED Talk by cardiologist James O'Keefe, whose son, Jimmy, came out to him as gay. And like any good parent, they dedicated the rest of their lives to fighting for LGBT equality.
And trying to discover, why did this happen to me?
And so the premise of his video is that homosexuality is nature's way to deal with environmental stress. That nature endows gay people with special skills to help their communities and their families to survive.
It's a little bit like Dr. O'Keefe was turning gay people into X-Men. Like he'd watched like the Bryan Singer scene with Iceman, and like the mom goes, "Have you tried not being a mutant?" You know, only he like completely fell off the metaphor and into like biological reductionism. Yeah.
And that's a common trope that we see in motion pictures, which Spike Lee calls the magic Negro. Which is minorities as characters represented in film sometimes fall into the trap, the writers do, of making these minority characters have some sort of angelic, altruistic function for the dominant heterosexual white male.
If you want an LGBT-specific trope, that's the gay best friend in like a female-centric movie. You have this gay character who's basically the choir and the advice mentor and the fashionista for the straight lonely business lady. They actually had one in the movie Catwoman, and he was sort of cut because they didn't want to be too controversial. So you just have this random gay guy in the background clapping at random times.
The Catwoman with Halle Berry?
Yeah, yeah. He's the one who buys her crazy leather suit. So I want to know about that relationship.
I want to see if that, I want to see that re-edited.
I want to see that case.
Cause that movie was so terrible.
I want to see like the conversation that went into them buying a crazy leather cat suit for her before she became Catwoman.
Vincent, the premise that James O'Keefe, the cardiologist, makes is that homosexuality is genetically programmed altruism. Are gays hardwired to help those brats that their brothers and sisters had grow up? Do we have, because we share common genes, and therefore he's saying that if it didn't have some sort of genetic advantage, that homosexuality would have been removed from our species long ago.
And that basically we're just helper monkeys.
Yeah. So that's the kin selection argument. That's something that's been proposed before. The idea is that, you know, altruism is seen in other animals and in people when you're more related to the people you're being altruistic for. So when you're siblings, you're like about 50% similar with your other sibling because each of you have like half your mom and half your dad. So you're probably 50% similar. From a selection standpoint, it's essentially the same if you have a child or your sibling has a child, assuming that your parents are the same people. You tend to see this relatedness bias in non-human primates and other mammals, where the more closely related to you the other animals are, the more likely it is that they're going to form a mutually altruistic group that increases the selective fitness of the whole. It's also one of the reasons why that they think bees have the selection strategy that they do. Bees are something called haplodiploid. So you're a female if you have both sets of chromosomes, and you're a male if you have half of your sets of chromosomes. Let's say if you were doing this in humans, a male would be an NF23 and a female would be an NF46.
So for bees, they define their gender biologically different than other animals do. Instead of an XY chromosome, it's the number of chromosomes that they have.
Yeah, yeah. And that means that the relatedness between workers is incredibly high. It's like 75% versus the 50% you see in other animals. So that means that if the queen is only made once and there's only one queen, all of those sisters in the colony are super closely related, which means that if they can manage to produce a queen from that same pool of worker siblings, then their reproductive success is passed on to her so that she becomes the bearer of like all of their future generations. So they all work toward that because they're all functionally identical.
So why is it so dangerous to think about natural selection when it comes to, say, sexuality or race or any kind of attributes that we have as people?
So the kin selection argument presupposes that homosexuals have an inborn function to provide group benefits to the entire population. The pitfall is that it's overly reductive. It leads to arguments like gays and lesbians are born with distinctive personalities and like strong intellects, right? I mean, there's some evidence to suggest that that might be a thing based on the Savannah hypothesis, the idea that like your intelligence can countermand the evolutionary imperatives imposed on the population by offering you a weird reproductive strategy. But other studies don't support that view, mostly because the effects they're seeing in the studies that say that gays and lesbians have weird distinctive personalities that like would add to the intellectual diversity of a group and promote this kin selection are not actually based on anything biological. It's based on executive function. So the idea is that because you have to navigate this new situation, you develop a different set of tools to deal with the emotional reality of your situation.
Right now, like most of the successful daytime talk shows were at one point in time hosted by gay men or lesbians. And I think that everybody should be paying attention to this podcast because it's hosted by two gay men and we have a lot of LGBT people. Mm-hmm. But you're saying that things arise by accident without necessarily any benefit. Carl Sagan sort of described evolution as sort of like you're not building the house from scratch. You're adding an addition to it. And sometimes things are just left behind just because they happen to arise randomly. And maybe homosexuality is one of those things.
Kinda, yeah. Humans are intensely social animals. So, I mean, there's probably a biological underpinning to homosexuality. I mean, there's some studies that suggest gene linkages and family dispositions toward homosexuality, but it doesn't necessarily mean that that trait in particular is something that is being selected for.
So it's like as though the gene for socialization just gets extra turned on with us.
It's like the gene for socialization. It's all, like all of the things that prime you to be social are interacting with something that affects your development, affects your neurology, mm-hmm. affects who you're attracted to, mm-hmm. and it just sort of gets transmitted over to the same sex as opposed to the opposite sex.
So for a straight guy, he might want the socialization might be to join a team, you know, pat somebody an ass, give them a hug. But for us, it's, you know, you go a little further.
Yeah. Like sexuality is actually like a combination of four different related phenomena. The behavior aspect, who are you having sex with, right? The identity that you have within your culture, the degree of attraction you have towards any particular person, and the physiological sexual arousal that you experience as a result of, you know, sexual stimuli. All of those things intersect with your own gender identity and your culture, which sort of like makes the question, are gay people super, super special evolutionarily, really complicated and difficult to parse, because the category of gay has only existed in an intensely modern context. Like, we didn't have the word for gay or the social class of gay throughout all of human evolution. Just to use gay as like an example, since everybody talking is gay. If we go back and look at like other cultures, or if we look at ancient history, we see that sexuality has a number of different approaches. To the Romans, you have this idea that like whoever is doing the topping is the male of the situation, and it's totally cool if you're a Roman man to be sexually interested in both men and women, so long as you are the one on top, or you're like having sex with somebody that you physically own as a slave. For them, it was a class and weird dominance thing. So there's that, but there's also like non-Western ideas of, you know, same-sex attraction, where it's paired with transgender expression. So in Samoa, you have the Fafine, and I know I've mispronounced that. I'm sorry, all of the Samoans who are listening to this, I don't know how to say it, who are biologically male, who are attracted to men, but they dress and present as women, and they enter into heterosexual relationships with other men and are treated as if they are a heterosexual couple. That social role also comes with a fair degree of something that sociologists term avuncularity, right? So they are helpful uncle figures mm-hmm. who then go out and help the rest of the community. It kind of ties into this homosexuality as shamanism thing that I know Fausto has linked me to, but it's something that you see in different cultures in different ways, and it doesn't necessarily follow that because gay people exist and we want to ascribe them special properties, that they have those special properties biologically. It can be a function of culture and conditioning.
Okay, so this phenomenon isn't always a benefit, but when it works, it works.
This phenomena is probably something that's always been happening, and it's on us as a culture to provide the space for people to do the things that make the most sense for them. If you're experiencing same-sex attraction, there have to be avenues for you to express that in order for the society to be, you know, functional. Otherwise, you're repressing people, and that leads to all sorts of terribleness.
And is that why, obviously, that studying sexuality in science raises so many, so much controversy in terms of funding, in terms of politics, in terms of, like, you know, conservative people in all cultures have always been, at least in modern times, been unified, despite, you know, for example, in the Middle East, you have Christian, Muslims, and Jews who disagree on just about everything, but they come together and form like treaties on their universal despise of homosexuality.
Even though they're all doing it.
I mean, is that a trick question, Fausto? Are you going to try to get me to say that it's not happening?
Maybe I'm asking the listeners and people who are out there, is there a biological component to homophobia?
I don't know. I haven't looked into that. I would say there are a lot of different reasons why people might be homophobic, and it's probably an expression of the same tribalism that makes people want to group into family, friend, and kin clusters. Same thing that makes you want to, you know, go out and, you know, be with other men if you're gay. You know, it's that same kind of social attraction, just not necessarily with the sexual component, but with the in-group, out-group, us versus them thing.
So why is it so dangerous to think about sexuality and having a purpose in biology? Because when we were getting ready, you're very concerned about eugenics. And on this show, we've had scientists that one of them who was literally a big dicked eugenicist who ascribed, you know, favorable conditions on men who had big dicks.
He was just a size queen.
He was a size queen mm-hmm. who literally studied large dicks, mm-hmm. like scientifically.
Personally, I don't necessarily need a large dick, but that's beside the point. The danger in trying to ascribe either a total positive or a total negative to any particular trait is that, one, you don't know if that's actually true. And the other is you end up with this like weird thing that you saw a lot of in like the late 1800s and early 1900s, where people were like entering themselves into pageants as whole families for their breeding, or trying to breed the best musicians, you know, like this idea
like
that like
the Von Trapps were like a genetic experiment.
No, like they're used to. Yeah. So, you know, beauty pageants, the whole beauty pageant scene emerged from this eugenic idea that like you could pick out the best bred people based on the traits they were exhibiting in the now. So beauty pageants are actually eugenics competitions.
Like, wow.
Like in heritage. Mm-hmm. So like, If we're going to be talking about a minority group, LGBT people, who've been historically medicalized and stigmatized against, it's a little creepy to try to like do the 180 and say, no, actually, the biological underpinnings of homosexuality make us superheroes, as opposed to the biological underpinnings of homosexuality make us into disabled people. Like, it's the same, it's the other half of that coin. It's the other face of that coin.
So you want to flip it the other way, but you do want to look at it from a different point of view.
And because the dangers of eugenics and homosexuality and biology is tied to the history of torture as an attempt to cure men, mostly, of their homosexuality. In fact, I think it was the United States and Russia tried to weaponize homosexuality through hormones. Mm. So these were hormone bombs they were trying to develop that when shot on soldiers would make them so horny and so gay that they would start having sex with each other instead of fighting a war. Of course, it didn't work out, but that this is actual documented research that was actually done. And so I always tell people, if there is a cure for homosexuality, you can turn that mechanism on its head and make other people go gay.
Yeah. See,
which is always dangerous either way.
Yeah. It's because of stuff like that and because of the medicalization of homosexual bodies as a flawed other that I'm really hesitant to buy into Dr. O'Keefe's rosy homosexual as like magical family healing person narrative. Mm-hmm. Like it seems like instead of accepting us as people, you're trying to pigeonhole us into yet another role that somehow benefits you.
What can you imagine to James O'Keefe in the TED Talk? Mm-hmm. Can you imagine his Jimmy's brothers and sisters who dad's like dedicating all his time to make this video and lecture about how awesome his gay son is and how his gay son's going to give him grandchildren. And meanwhile, his straight brothers and sisters are like, Dad, will you just shut the fuck up? Mm-hmm. I'm doing the best I can.
Well, it also seems like he's really trying to justify, like, you know, his son. And it's kind of like you have to have this idea of like who we are is good enough, you know, just because we are people, it's enough. And, you know, people look at they use these medical things against us in the past to deny us of our rights. And so if you look at it, it's like, hey, if we send the positives, like maybe we'll get our rights. But it shouldn't have to be like that. We're human beings. We're people. We should have equality just like anybody else, whether we have some kind of perceived usefulness or benefit to society. You know, because if it comes down to that way, then it's like, you know, you would be taking rights away from people that are disabled, or you'd be bestowing, you know, rights on people that, you know, have like more money. Imagine that. Or of a different gender.
Well, and certainly, like, you know, you do see that happening in entertainment and sports, like the most racist white men who own basketball teams love their black athletes. They're just like, oh my God, these black athletes are endowed with magic powers and they can, you know, and part of it is like, it's this weird incongruence, right? And I really kind of wanted to take the opportunity here to bring up all these studies that we've talked about on the podcast for the last 13 years. And as a gay adult, like I came out in 1990, and throughout the course of my lifetime, I've seen science go from trying to understand what sexuality is to trying to understand the mechanisms of how it manifests itself in a person. And I want to sort of begin and I hear your perspective about this, Vincent, because I know you have a lot to say about it. One of the most common types of studies is twin studies. Mm-hmm, and these have been going on through the years. The most famous one is 1991's Bailey and Pillard, where they found 161 sets of twins through ads in gay publications. These twins had both been raised together since at least the age of two. And surprisingly, the 52% of identical twins were both gay, and 22% of fraternal twins were both gay. And since that study was announced, they were sort of like saying, see, there's a biological component to homosexuality. There's done a lot of studies, some in Australia and some in Switzerland, and that number starts dropping and dropping. as a scientific method gets more rigorous mm-hmm. and the sample size gets bigger and bigger.
And one of the problems with the earlier study is that they felt like the people were more likely to engage in the study if they knew their brother was gay. Like if they were gay and their brother was straight, they probably wouldn't have participated. But I think they did a broader reach to find more and varied people.
I believe that Sweden actually studied everybody who was a twin in their country to find out the mechanism of their homosexuality. Mm.
So if you're talking about twin studies, that initial study, you know, sets the high watermark for the monozygotic twin as like a 52% similarity, right? 52% concurrence. The idea that like if your twin brother who's identical to you is gay, there's a 52% chance that you will also be gay. The 24% that you're talking about for dizygotic twins that are not identical, that indicates that there's an environmental component of some kind to the expression of homosexuality as a trait. So the reason why that's important is because we're looking at a complex trait that's like the union of genetic predisposition and the development that you have as a child and as a uterus. In utero.
So like Gringas and Chen in 2001 described a number of mechanisms which could lead to those differences, and most of them being tied to the uterus and that twins will have different placenta even if they have identical genetics.
That's sweet, sweet placenta.
They'll also have different epigenetic traits. Monozygotic twins will have a really high degree of genetic similarity. They're not going to have the same expression profiles. So, like, there are a number of mechanisms.
Will you explain that for people, the epigenetic? Because I don't think a lot of people might understand that.
Yeah. So, epigenetics is, at its simplest, the interaction between your genome and the environment. Your body, your cells have a ton of different mechanisms that they use to regulate the turning on and turning off of your genes. There's methylation. You attach like a little carbon group to the genome and that can switch a gene off or on. There's histone rearrangement. So you coil the genetic material so that like the proteins that would bind to the DNA to turn the gene on.
James O'Keefe explained it as like you can have two ants that are genetically identical, and one could be this big muscular ant, and the other one could be a teeny tiny little ant, sort of like the movie Twins with Danny DeVito and Arnold Schwarzenegger, right?
Right.
They were supposed to be identical twins, but because one's epigenetics, one was raised.
Oh, that was just a joke, though.
I know, it's meant to be a joke, but the premise was a terrible example.
The ants are actually a better example.
but the premise is that if you gave a different environment, can have certain genes turn on and manifest themselves.
Yes. So if you're looking at two identical twins, their expression profiles are not going to be the same. Like the methylation sites, the histones, all the crazy stuff I just mentioned. All that stuff is probably going to be different because you and your twin do not experience precisely the same environment. Mm-hmm. You're going to experience incredibly different environments if for some reason you and your identical twin are separated.
And this is kind of like in this show we just did about a week ago called The Fountain of Youth, where it's like, so if you work out in a gym, that's, and you lift weights, that affects your genes in a certain way.
Your
genetic expression. And so it adds to longevity because your little telomeres don't erode as quickly.
You're helping to turn on the beneficial aspects of your DNA. Mm. And so like
everything changes your genetic expression. Yeah. There's nothing you can do that won't.
Eating, sleeping, everything does that.
Yeah, literally everything. It's sort of like your brain in that every experience you have changes the connections that your neurons make to each other. So in a way, just by living, you are continuously rewriting your brain's circuitry, right? So, like, that's also an aspect that goes into same-sex attraction because you're going to be dealing with different hormonal environments sometimes. You'll be dealing with different gene expression profiles, and that will alter the architecture of the brain, too.
Vincent, in a lot of movies, there's an archetype of the evil twin.
Right? Do you think I'm the evil twin?
Oh, I don't know. Do you have another sibling?
I have a bunch of siblings, but I'm like the oldest brother, I guess.
But in movies, like in The Simpsons is most famous, right? It was the, I don't want to give it away, but spoiler alert, it was an episode of The Simpsons where they discover that Bart has an evil twin living in the attic. He's been chained. But it turns out that Bart is the evil twin and the good twin had been switched and locked up in the attic.
Is this going to turn into a question about whether or not there's the gay twin? Because that's awesome.
It's interesting, right? So, like, this archetype that we have in popular culture that people who are identical in every way can have an evil twin.
The doppelganger.
The doppelganger, yeah. It's this idea that you have some, this, you know, alternate universe villain version of yourself.
And they have a goatee. And they pilot a version of the Enterprise that's painted black on the inside. Mm-hmm.
But if you
there's no hand railings anywhere. It's awful.
If you are a twin, though, isn't it like you're more likely to be gay? Isn't that the case as well? I think I read that somewhere.
Right? And to be in porn.
I don't know if that's the case. I know that if your twin is gay, you are more likely to be gay. There's also another like linkage in families where in maternal lines, you tend to see more clustering of gay men in certain families. And that's been linked to a couple different genes on the X chromosome. So there appears to be X-linked predisposition towards same-sex attraction in gay men.
And that's the 1993 Dean Hammer study that examined 76 gay brothers and their families.
That's one of them. Uh-huh. There's also a genome linkage scan from 2010 done by, I can't pronounce half these names because most of them are Indian, Ragopalandiamond. Oh, God, these are awful. I can't do this. There's a lot of people.
Awful, they're just different.
Oh, my God.
No, they're not awful. I'm just annoyed at my own lack of culture that I can't say these names without butchering them.
Specifying here on the sort of the gay uncle school of study is that the idea is there's a lot of controversy because it goes back to this idea that there's a gay gene. And so they were studying, they're looking at 76 gay brothers and their families, and they found out that gay men had more gay male uncles and cousins on the maternal side of the family than on the paternal side. Therefore, if you're gay, your mom's uncle had a 13% chance of being gay. But if you're gay, your dad's uncle had a 6% chance of being gay.
But there's also another study that says that, you know, that women who have gay relatives are 20% like more fertile than regular women. So that idea of like having gay uncles is like, you know, how people always, oh, my gay uncle. It's almost always on your mother's side of the family. And then a lot of people do have gay uncles because women with gay brothers have a lot more kids.
So the gay uncle occurs when the woman's having a lot of babies. Mm-hmm.
Well, the gay uncle is already there.
Not necessarily.
He's a gay brother, and then she has a bunch of babies, then it becomes a gay uncle, right?
So what you're talking about is a linkage analysis. We're talking about, like, the degree to which, like, the trait breaks with, like, certain tags you see in the genome. On chromosomes 8 and the X chromosome, you have a couple of regions that are correlated with homosexuality, but they don't appear to be like the cause of homosexuality. So what the modern consensus is there is a genetic like component to same-sex attraction, especially in gay men, but it's a network of different genes on different genomes, some of which are attached to the maternal line because that's where you get your X chromosomes from. The boost in fertility you're talking about is the sexually antagonistic hypothesis, the idea that like the genes that go into making a woman more fertile might make the men that come from her line less fertile and more likely to be homosexual. And that's something that's been seen in two studies, one in Italy and one again in Samoa, but it's something that's not been widely replicated, partially because a lot of the studies on this are either very small or not terribly well thought out. Yeah, it's one of these things that's very difficult to write a grant for because you're dealing with human subjects and you're dealing with sexuality and you're dealing with a conservative government administration that would rather paint homosexuality as something unnatural and therefore wrong, rather than examine it as a phenomenon that occurs in people as part of the breadth of human diversity.
Let's take a look at the 1997 study, Blanchard and Klassen, about gay siblings. And this is a lot of people who study this topic say it's probably one of the most popular studies that reported.
Oh, yeah, this one's referenced literally all the time.
So this is the one that you guys have heard on this podcast, that if you're gay, for every older brother increases the odds of a man being gay by 33%. In other words, if you're the youngest of five brothers, you're pretty much guaranteed to be gay, like Mark Phelan here.
Even after like three brothers, it's like a 90-some percent chance of
that's
being gay.
That's actually not quite a correct reading of the statistics. So the 33% bump is off of the baseline chance in the general population of being homosexual. In order to get to a 50% chance of being gay, like you need to have 10 sons sequentially in the same mother.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's a really small...
Which in some villages does occur.
Oh, yeah, totally. But it's a smaller effect than people tend to think it is. Mm. And it doesn't explain everything about what goes into same-sex attraction in men. Again, we're talking about multiple genes that have been identified. We're talking about birth order. We're talking about hormonal environment. And we're talking about, like, really niche selective hypotheses where... Like some genes are working more for women and their reproductive success than for men and their reproductive success. It's a complex stew.
Mark, you had a sort of
of sexuality.
Mark, you had a certain philosophy about this phenomena, which was like the youngest in a Catholic family usually wound up becoming the priest.
A lot. Well, especially like when you look at in Europe, they would have this idea of primogeniture, right? Whereas the firstborn son inherited everything. So they took everything. And so if you had other sons, that you know, the other sons might go off and get a profession or a trade, you know, but oftentimes one of them would become a priest, and was often the youngest son would go off and become a priest. And so he, or a monk or whatever. And so he'd go live with other men. And, you know, we all know what happens then.
And that's what sort of a philosopher...
Really good beer.
Mm-hmm. Really good beer, but philosopher Harry Hay, founder of the
Radical Fairies.
Radical Fairies. He believed in the idea of the gay shaman. So in 1979, Harry Hay, he was an activist who helped found the organizations like the Mattachine Society that helped organize LGBT groups after Stonewall. Into the modern gay rights movement that we know today. And so Harry Hay said that he founded the Radical Fairies as a queer group to help reawaken public consciousness on the function of the gay man as a spiritual leader in their community. And so it was the idea that we needed to separate homosexuality from the Catholic Church, because the Catholic Church had corrupted our nature as healers and leaders and thought provokers.
I like the sentiment of that, but I also am I'm always really cautious about like 60s countercultural notions of spirituality, because they tend to either borrow or co-opt very heavily from like Native American or non-Western cultures in a way that I think is kind of school wiki, you know, like okay. While I would love for gay men to have this like interesting magical status, it kind of goes back to the problem I was outlining earlier, where if you're like using biological determinism or same-sex attraction as the lens through which you're like seeing all things magical and you're expecting that of people, that you're getting into that same problem then, aren't you?
Yeah. Like, so you basically become sort of the gay Uncle Remus in Song of the South, or the Oda Mae Brown, Whoopi Goldberg in Ghost. You know, you're sort of Chris Rock in the movie Dogma, or I'm looking here at the Magic Negro archetype throughout film, you know, and sort of like, you know, what is it? The movie, the TV series Will and Grace. Mm-hmm. It definitely has that functionality, that Will's purpose is to get Grace's groove back. Mm. Right. And even in ironically, like the House Della got her groove back ultimately became a story of how a woman got her groove back by forming a romantic sexual relationship with a closeted gay man.
Yeah, she didn't know, and then she found out that he was gay later on.
Maybe Stella should have gone to ancient Inca territory and given Cusco his groove back by demonstrating that you just need to find a closeted gay man.
Now, this is my favorite study of them all, considering that Trump is now in the news because he allegedly likes urine in sex, right?
Did you find this after you found the lions on YouTube or before?
I don't know. It just came out.
This is an ongoing for Feast of Fun Enterprises. Mark and I are and the listeners are vigorously researching and looking and lifting every rock on the internet to find some unusual piece of information or study or news or tidbit. And just want to draw attention to our Facebook group, Friends of the Show, Feast of Fun Friends of the Show, where you can share amazing things that you found on the internet, and we'll bring them up on the podcast on a future date. So this study done by Lindstrom and in 2005 examined how gay and straight men responded differently to scent, to odors that are believed to be involved in sexual arousal. So the gay guys and the straight women loved it when they were sniffing a man's sweat and their region in their hypothalamus got activated. Women's pee got straight guys horny, had a very similar response to an estrogen-like compound found in women's urine. The study concluded that sexual attraction works on a deeply biological level and suggested that in future studies could be explored by studying young subjects to see if similar responses to the hypothalamus were found, and then finding out in the future if those children grew up to becoming gay individuals based on their hypothalamus response to these scents.
That's actually very interesting, because that lines up with a study that was done a few years back on scent and attraction in terms of genetic diversity and immunological diversity. It kind of made a stir. So you have a protein that every cell in your body expresses called the major immunohistocompatibility MHC. Let's just go with the acronym MHC.
Okay.
Because I can't say the words So it turns out that people who tend to smell good to you have a diverse or different region on that molecule that's related to how your body determines what itself is, right? That's a molecule that your body uses to be like, hey, that's bacteria, this is cancer, this is bad, this is good. So, like, in other words, you are predisposed to be attracted to things that are different from you on an immunological level for the purpose of possibly survival, right? It's like, oh, there's a sexual component to remixing the immune system. So I totally buy that there's like a deep biological drive that you can see in brain activity based on like who it is you're attracted to. It totally lines up for me.
Well, isn't that the reason why even kissing in humans and primates occurs, is because it's a quick way to sort of like taste the other person you're going to have sex with to see if you're going to catch something or, you know, to get a sense of their biology.
I mean, if you're kissing someone to see if you're going to catch something, you might have already caught it.
But so. It's a lot better to catch a cold than say in past, you know, societies, an STI was deadly. You know, it's not just HIV, but a lot of people died from other types of sexually transmitted infections and without antibiotics. And so it was much safer, say, to catch herpes or a cold from somebody by kissing them than just going up and banging directly. And so and some people are suggesting that maybe that's why kissing arose in our species and similar primates, is because it was a way of sort of like exchanging data, information, diseases, and to see if that person was compatible, because otherwise you would die.
That's really interesting. I haven't read any of those, but it would line up from the other things we've been talking about. Like, it makes, you know, it passes the smell test, as it were, since we're talking about smell.
Now, this is a study that I remember in my early years as coming out as gay.
Oh, yeah. This is the one somebody tried to get you involved in, right?
Shut the fuck up. So this is a study that was in the news, very controversial in 1991. It was a neuroscientist, Simon LeVay.
Yeah, they wanted you to participate in.
Shut up, Mark.
So was Fausto dead in 1991?
Yeah.
So I'm sure somebody wanted him to be.
So it was a controversial study that examined the brains of 41 deceased hospital patients. So these were 19 gay men who had died from AIDS-related illnesses and had given their bodies to science. Mm-hmm. 16 of those men in the studies, whose sexual orientation was unknown, was presumed to be heterosexual. 6 heterosexual men who died from AIDS-related illnesses but didn't catch it through gay sex. 6 women who are presumed to be heterosexual and 1 woman who is heterosexual who died from AIDS. So it was the study concluded that homosexual males had a female hypothalamus, which at the time was scandalous because one, it was
nobody knew what a hypothalamus was.
Yeah, right? People were just up in arms about the terminology.
They're like, "Oh, what? You can't say that on television."
But part of it was that because he came across as sort of this like mad gay scientist who was cracking the brains open of dead gay men who had altruistically given their bodies to science, and he was abusing their goodwill by saying, you know, you're just a woman deep inside. You're not a person, you know, because we associate, we have such an internalized sexism that to challenge a person's identity or validity is to compare them to be female. And so in 1991, for Simon LeVay to sort of come to this conclusion of a very skimpy study, because it was very difficult to find cadavers to examine the brains who you knew the sexual identity of, right? And to come to a very quick conclusion based on 41 cases that gay men have a female brain, essentially, was not well received. And ultimately, Simon LeVay suffered in his career as a scientist tremendously from it. We invited Simon to come on the podcast to talk about his experience on it. And he said, no, thank you. I'm retired. I don't want to bring up the past.
Yeah. The LeVay study is interesting because it's based on a lot of brain studies that were done on mice and rats that had been subjected to different hormones in utero and different hormones in development, because you did see this interesting shift in brain architecture in mice and in behavior in mice, depending on what kind of sex hormones they'd been exposed to during growth in the womb. But the LeVay study is also kind of problematic because, you know, it's a really small sample size, but later studies that have been done haven't like demonstrated the same degree of phenomena that he saw. So it, since there hasn't really been much follow-up and the only few follow-ups haven't really, you know, corroborated the story, we're sort of just left with a fairly large question mark. Like, did LeVay see something? Probably, but is that something that's like broad? We don't know. And we also don't know if that something is something that's caused by AIDS. You know,
he was looking at, you know, women and heterosexual men's brains who had died from AIDS to see if it was the medication or the condition of having HIV.
But when you only have when you only have like one heterosexual woman or 6 cadavers of a certain clade, it's just not enough to make a broad statement like that.
Sure.
Science is hard for this reason, because you need a metric fuck ton of data to like make a broad assertion. And
in Star Trek, when we see sort of the doctor do computer generated simulations in order to find information about new species, that's completely like out of left field, isn't it?
Like, you'd need to Oh God. Like Star Trek's a crazy example because like, it's like thousands, it's like several hundred years in the future and who knows what kind of technology they have. So maybe that's okay. I don't know. It just seems like, it's hard to make leaps like that is what I'm trying to say. And the studies that have been done on animals have shown some interesting results, but again, this is something you really can't do in human beings.
Okay. One of my favorite studies that we've covered on this podcast is women's reaction to porn. And this took place at, mostly at the University of Essex, Cornell University, and here in Chicago at Northwestern University.
That's actually Evanston.
Which is, well, Evanston's part, you know, it's a political thing to say that Evanston's part of Chicago or not.
Well, Evanston is like a town north of Chicago.
The greater Chicagoland metro area.
You could say Chicagoland, yeah.
So anyways, Brian Mustansky, I believe, who is a past guest of our show, was involved in the study. And they recruited 500 straight, bisexual, and lesbian women to come into the lab and have their pussies and their eyeballs hooked up to machines to, and they showed them porn. Mm-hmm. The porn that they showed them was
Lions on YouTube.
Lions on YouTube.
Oh wait, no, that wasn't you. You weren't in the study, right?
Yeah. So the exams looked at blood flow near the vagina and pupil dilation, and they showed them men, women, and couples and lesbians masturbating basically, and wanted to see what the reaction was. And they found that straight women were strongly sexually aroused to videos of both attractive men and attractive women, even though they reported before being shown the videos that they were only interested in men. Lesbians, however, were more masculine in their sexual responses and only were attracted to women, mm-hmm. whereas straight men and lesbians wanted to only be turned on by the things that they stated to prefer, whereas heterosexual women were comfortable in both things.
The straight women, to lay it down, they said that they were straight and they were really only attracted to men, but the images of women on women and men with women also turned them on.
So the name of the guy who initiated the controversial study, because it was basically the press was going, there is no such thing as straight women. Mm-hmm. Jeroff Reiger, he said, no. Although most women identify as straight in their physiological sexual responses, they're gay or bisexual, but seldom ever in the minority are identify as only exclusively being turned on by men when they identify as heterosexual. He went on to theorize that many millennia ago, forced copulation was standard practice amongst humans, and that the female response to any sexual stimulus could have evolved in part to mitigate this risk. Meaning, if you read between the lines, that basically women's flexibility in being turned on by a variety of sexual stimuli arose because women were forced to have sex against their will.
That's a really large leap to make. That's a really large leap to make based on that. Like...
Is Jeroff trying to get his girlfriend to have a three-way, and this is like a very elaborate scheme?
I really hope not. But like, oh God. So when you're talking about like, so remember that we talked about there being four factors in like sexuality and all that stuff. He's only looking at like literal physical arousal. He's not actually like doing any kind of questionnaire afterwards about attractiveness or about behavior. So his conclusions demonstrate that women might have a more fluid sense of arousal toward certain things, but doesn't actually say anything about what that means for, you know, people in the day to day. There's another study that looks at like men and women's reported sexual orientation and their the people they're attracted to that kind of shows a similar thing without the rape angle, where you have men who express a very strong preference towards women or men, and you have women who express a strong preference toward men, but there's more women who openly identify as bisexual. It's just something that's seen in like the trend line. So mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Like I would hesitate to say that that's like some kind of evolution towards rape tolerance. And maybe I really don't know what that means, but I would say that's a fairly large leap to make, you know, like it. One, that's kind of gross. And two, his evidence doesn't really support that. It just shows that women have a more fluid sense of what arouses them than, you know, men.
Yeah, and certainly there could be a wide variety of factors why this is happening. Maybe it just might be the inherent physical qualities of that women are sort of stuck with the kid.
Mm-hmm.
When they have sex, they're carrying the kid around. And so it's much more of an investment on their bodies than a man who can impregnate a woman and doesn't have to be stuck with the consequences of having a baby. And so therefore women might be aroused to be more flexible in terms of their sexuality because of this sheer difference in how we procreate. Who knows?
There's also this 1975 study by Goy R. and Goldfoot. It's a neuroendocrinology study that demonstrates that animals, mammals in particular, will have one biological sex that has a broader arousal pattern than the other biological sex. So it doesn't always track male-female. It just happens to be one or the other across different animal lineages. So like what we're seeing here could be something like that. Where women just happen to be the sex in humans that has a broader arousal pattern, and men just happen to be more picky.
And why are animals so gay? I mean, it's like, you know,
I don't know, man. Maybe it was just all those Judy Garland broadcasts just gaying up the animal kingdom.
Well, some like animals are gay, but they kind of like they bond and raise kids together. But are they actually fucking?
So you're talking about like the penguins, your Humboldt penguins named after your gay scientists. These are very popular gay couples at zoos. And it's very common now for zoos to give orphan chicks to same sex penguin couples,
which is something that happens actually in the wild where same sex penguin couples will forcibly adopt abandoned chicks or chicks that have lost their parents. There's not, as far as I know, much evidence of like male-male or female-female mounting happening in birds. I know that black swans will form male-male pairs, recruit females, have eggs with them, and then drive the females away from the nest so that they can raise the chicks by themselves. Sort of like a really aggressive and subversive version of surrogacy. So, I mean, it's a behavior that's replicated across birds, but I'm not sure how much fucking is happening, as it were, you know, in that stuff.
But like the birds and primates, mammals love to go gay, but insects seldom do, I guess, right? It's like, even though the times that insects have sex with each other when they're
usually
gay
lead to death, yeah,
you know. And well, so
like the times insects have sex in general usually lead to them dying. Although there's some evidence that it happens in dragonflies, you tend to see this weird bite mark pattern that would indicate that males have accidentally tried to mount each other, which they don't really know what that means yet.
Are you sure it was an accident?
Exactly. You know,
again, we don't know what it means. Dick went right up my butt.
Man, if only I hadn't bit you in that spot, we would totally have had tons of eggs together.
What about parthenogenesis? I feel like we, you know, there's so much
we're
to talk about.
We're dancing around the parthenogenesis. It was,
and I sort of want to start up by talking about you know, gender identity, gender transformation in the animal kingdom. But that's a whole nother show. But I just want to scratch the surface here before we wrap things up. Whiptail lizards are lizards that reproduce just like the Virgin Mary. Without having sex, they're just spontaneously giving birth to offspring that are pretty much genetic clones of themselves. And I had a biology teacher in college who said, if Virgin Mary Magdalene, Mary Magdalene, Mark is the Virgin Mary, right? I'm not.
Mary Magdalene is not the Virgin.
Different
Mary.
Person, yes.
You're Mary of Nazareth. There are lots
just
of Mary.
The Virgin Mary. Just call her Mary's just father.
The mother. Virgin Mother.
The Virgin Mother. Mary. Yeah. Our Lady Mary. Of Sorrows. Our Lady of the Sweet Hereafter.
Okay, so
Our Lady of Guadalupe.
So if the lady in the nativity scene in your mom's living room underneath the Christmas tree, if she actually had a boy, Jesus would have had to been a woman or trans. Now get So he says there actually have been reported cases of women giving birth to boys with all female genetics. In 1995, there was one case of that.
So that actually is not a real story. Like, women occasionally are parthenogenic, but the embryos don't come to term. They tend to die fairly early on. It's like it's a miscarriage. They lack certain they lack the genes necessary to tell them what to do because the embryo doesn't divide properly. It doesn't have a full set of genes. So
it does happen, but 99.99% of the time it doesn't result in a living person.
Like 100% of the time it doesn't work. You need to find a way to make the gametes, the eggs in a woman, have a full set of chromosomes.
There is a publicized case in 1995. There was of a boy being all female genetically and was suffering from medical problems. And when the doctors examined the genetics of this boy, he was genetically identical to his mother, and being female, but manifested as male.
Interesting. You'd have to forward that to me.
I think it was on the cover of the National Enquirer too. So don't.
Oh my god!
Have you ever heard? I'm just kidding.
Have you ever heard those stories of like those people that like I absorbed my own twin? There was a woman. She like went and had a baby, and like they're like, this baby's not your kid. This baby is your sister's kid. And they're like, I don't have a sister. And so her the one twin in the uterus absorbed the other one. So certain organs in her body tested her own genetics, and other organs tested for her absorbed twin. And her ovaries.
That'll happen. That'll happen when the embryos are still, you know, clusters of cells. Mm-hmm. So it's like it's not like they not one like partially developed baby is eating the other partially developed baby, like in Venture Brothers. It's more like the clusters of cells get close together and merge, and one of them ends up becoming some of the organs of the other one, which is a really. It's a really rare case of chimericism. Hmm.
Chimera meaning that like you're a creature of two different beings.
Yes.
Like David Bowie.
Now there's actually a recent short science fiction piece on human parthenogenesis called The New Mother. It's actually a really good read. It's about a sexually transmitted virus that results in viable self-fertilizing women that produce essentially clones of themselves, and the impacts that has on society and the crazy impact it has on the pro-life movement in particular. It's actually really good. It's available for free on Medium. So if any of you are interested in The New Mother, that's actually a really interesting perspective on that topic.
Send me a link to the sci-fi story, and I'll post the link to the virgin birth case in 1995. And you listeners can read and learn more about the biology of homosexuality, parthenogenesis, and other sort of exotic fields of science that are controversial and just beginning to be understood. Vincent, what would happen if we managed to remove homosexuality from our society biologically? Like if we could actually give someone an injection and in quotations stop their attraction to somebody of their same gender. Is this like tomatoes where removing the things that make them last longer on a shelf would also remove the flavor we like?
I mean, I'd argue that yeah, like if you're chemically altering somebody, you know, with some kind of weird drug that affects their psychology, there's all sorts of crazy unintended consequences for that. You know, in like depression medication commercials, you often see that one of the side effects of the depression medication is depression. Like, I don't think this is something you should chemically try to remove. I don't think it's something you can fix with conversion therapy. I think we're dealing with a really complicated thing that it's better to express in a safe and loving way rather than, you know, try to fix anything. Because there's nothing to fix here. It's just another facet of human diversity.
Or is it diverse as she?
I mean, if you want to call it that.
Is it a good idea to, it's probably a bad idea to have every member of your species competing for the same exact niche. Diversity is not just this, like, ad for Benetton. It's not just this feel-good idea that makes Republicans angry.
So it's
what corporations are doing today. Successful corporations today value diversity because it gives them the resources they need to thrive and succeed. And one of the problems with Trump's immigrant ban and the inherent racism, homophobia, and xenophobia in his policies is that a lot of tech companies and corporations are very alarmed because it interferes with their ability to do business, to succeed.
There's actually been studies on this because there's been studies on probably everything where when you give problems to solve to a set of computers that all have the same programming, it takes them a lot longer than giving a problem to a set of computers that each have different programs that they are good at in terms of like neural networks. And if you apply that to people, if you bring a bunch of people who have the same exact background to a problem, they often end up coming up with solutions to problems that take longer or aren't actually as good. You need a diversity of thought, a diversity of experience in order to have the necessary perspective to have all of the tools you need to solve complicated problems. And so if someone is going to try to remove homosexuality, remove LGBT people from the equation because of some weird religious or political agenda, they're really just removing something that would ultimately probably benefit humanity in the long term, not in like a strictly biological way, but in a diversity of thought sort of way.
So in a way, back to the beginning, Dr. James O'Keefe, the cardiologist, who sort of had this feel-good idea that homosexuality benefits families and communities, is true.
In a way, but it's not because we're magical people who are like super, super smart and super, super emotionally capable all the time. It's because having a bunch of people who are different from each other and have different experiences, you know, makes the group as a whole more able to combat challenges. And so that applies to everybody.
Vincent, that's such a beautiful way of putting it. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for coming on the show today and chewing so many diverse and exotic and outrageous, you know, thank some you. Of them very commonplace, some very outrageous attempts to understand who we are as people by looking at our sexuality.
Of course, it was really fun.
Now you're trying to get into graduate school to study science journalism.
Yes, I am.
And I hope that somebody who's listening to this, who's able to make a decision in your favor and give you lots of money.
Get on me, admissions committee.
Because mm-hmm. you do a lot of great work, and people can follow you on Twitter.
Mm-hmm. And I also have a Medium account that's sort of inactive right now because I've been, you know, working full time and applying full time. And they can also find my work on Queerica.com. I help edit that website, although we've also had problems with posting because of, the other editor is doing his PhD right now. So
Russian hackers trying to invade the internet.
Oh, yeah. Russian hackers have destroyed all of my blog posts. It's terrible.
You know, the weirdest thing is that until this election, I never paid any attention to all the Russian spam that we got in the comments section mm-hmm. of FISAFun.com. Yeah. I would just delete it, you know. But like, we seldom get spam from other countries and other cultures as much as we get stuff with Cyrillic words. And
yeah. It's weird.
It's really, really unnerving.
It's super weird.
Yeah.
There's some evidence that like the Russian propaganda apparatus employs like armies of trolls and botnets and like actual extremist groups of multiple political stripes to sow like confusion as to what they're actually trying to do. Mm-hmm. That's something
they have the money for it.
Yeah. Yeah. it's something that's covered in this documentary Hypernormalization by like Adam Curtis. It's actually a really interesting watch.
Well, is that why it's like it's probably more important now than ever to sort of turn to things like podcasts or video blogs in terms of like sort of forming your own opinions and instead of reading, you know, comments and forums, which may be just artificial machines pretending to be human?
I'd say try to find like the most reputable, well-sourced thing you possibly can. Whether that's a podcast, a writer, a reporter that you know, find something that you can trust and you can maybe go and take a couple steps towards verifying. I mean, not everything can be, but you can find people who are fairly reputable.
It's interesting that empirical evidence, knowledge, facts, science has been politicized by Republicans, by Russian oligarchs, by Trump, and turned it into a political issue in this day and age. And right now, people who are identify as scientists, who are employed as scientists, or are enthusiastic or passionate about science, are organizing a march on Washington for science. And the New York Times raises a flag about it. Robert Young says, trying to recreate the political women's march in Washington for science will only serve to reinforce the narrative from skeptical conservatives that scientists are an interest group and politicize their data, research, and findings to suit their own ends. Is the science march a good idea, Vincent?
I would say that scientists don't really have a choice in the matter anymore. Scientists as a community have been politicized since the intelligent design, evolution, creationism debate in public schools. We've been political since, you know, social Darwinism was like the key hit thing to promote, you know, in the public sphere. Science has always been political, even if it hasn't acknowledged that it has political impacts and consequences, or has been politicized if it's been trying to avoid being political. There's really no avoiding it when you're like a thing that happens in public. So if scientists want to be taken seriously, we need to like go out there and make our voices heard, because this approach that Young is advocating, where you're just supposed to walk up to local people and talk to them privately in their offices, doesn't really work, not in a national level, and doesn't really work from the perspective of making people aware that the entire scientific community has reached a consensus on things and that no amount of disinformation will change that.
You usually hear conservatives and Trump oligarch worshippers point out that Bill Nye is not a scientist, as if somehow being the term of scientist is something that's bestowed upon you by some board. But a scientist can be anybody who perceives things objectively through observation and reaches a conclusion based on having a control group, having a procedure and rejecting their own beliefs when in the face of data.
Yeah, science is a method for understanding reality. It's not a ploy. It's not like an obfuscation. It's just the best way we have to figure out what goes into the black box of the things that we see in the universe around us. You know, it's not readily apparent why things happen all the time. So you have to get really nitty gritty with the questions you ask so you can figure out, you know, what the cause and effect is. And it's not always intuitive either. Like any quantum physicist will tell you that quantum physics is like really counterintuitive, you know, because you just don't see it. So like my response to the idea that scientists have some sort of like weird cabal or weird conspiracy is to, you know, go to an academic conference and watch them backbite each other about arcane minutiae in like protein cascades or something else that's really esoteric. It's clear that there are points of contention, but not about like the method or the broad theoretical underpinnings of the disciplines themselves.
Why does 10% seem to be like a number that pops up when you're talking about minorities and their function in society? Because I was thinking about this, you know, certainly in the 90s, there was like publications called 10% that looked at, you know, they identified sort of the idea of the gay ratio in mm-hmm. society, you know, that one out of 10. And it happens that student teacher ratios, in some studies have said that the ideal student teacher ratio is 1 in 10, one teacher per every 10 students. And it happens that left-handedness manifests itself 10% mm-hmm. in society.
Oh, I think the current number for like LGBT people is like 4 or 5%, isn't it?
Well, and, so, it's, and it's, according to the CDC, it
depends on the country. It's like between like 6 to 10 is the number that I've seen bandied about. I know Kinsey put it as high as 37, but Kinsey was probably talking to people who were either a really selected population or were over-reporting their activities. So I don't know why 10% is such an important number. I feel
is it
like
a nice
the number,
round number that we can sort of yeah. like attach, because I mean, we have 10 fingers.
You've got 10 fingers, you got 10 toes. It's a number that like fits conceptually well into the brain. You know, and it's a nice number in like our numerical system, because it's just the tens place and then the hundreds place and the thousands place. So, you know, it just kind of nestles nicely.
And maybe the concept is that a minority can have a profound impact on the majority. That
oh, indeed. Yeah.
Just because something isn't the most popular manifestation doesn't mean that it's not valuable to everybody as a whole. And like you said about diversity, it's like diversity ultimately is what's going to win the day. And that means having little 10% of this and that. I mean, there's a reason. Was it most U.S. presidents, with exception of Donald Trump, were left-handed?
That's interesting.
Which is remarkable, I think. And I was talking about this with my mom, who's a big lefty, both politically, and she's also a left-handed person. And she says that, you know, being left-handed is sort of like being gay, is that you don't take things for granted. You know, we live in a right-handed world. So like scissors and doorknobs and, you know, computer return keys are on the right-hand side of the keyboard. And so when you're every day, you're sort of forced and awakened to be conscious about how things are, a queer person, a gay person, or a left-handed person, is going to question those things and become more conscious of the systems that we're surrounded by, ultimately being able to be better leaders than someone who takes the system for granted.
I mean, that's a beautiful sentiment. There's probably some truth in that.
Maybe so, or maybe not.
Vincent, no, I'm sorry. I'm just super conservative with like jumping on top of things. I'm not trying to belittle that point. It is a really beautiful point.
Maybe so, but we don't know. And that's but the thing about science, is that sometimes mm-hmm. beautiful ideas are just that.
And sometimes beautiful ideas turn out to be how things, you know, mm-hmm. actually happen.
And left-handedness used to be viewed as like sinister, and people evil. Like didn't trust left-handed people.
And they try to cure people of being left-handed.
Just like being gay.
And left-handedness really comes in handy during duels. It's really scary. Mm-hmm. I don't know. That's a random point.
Sword? You mean like a sword fight? You can switch swords from hands?
I was just being silly. Because I completely lost the train of where I was going. And that's the first thing that came to mind for reasons. Who knows?
Vincent, your background is in immunology and microbial disease.
Indeed.
So that's like you study how like crocs fight. What is like microbial disease like, in what way specifically?
So my specialty was in the innate immune system and the way it played with bacterial infections in the lung. So it's your body isn't just like the production of antibodies and that whole business. There's a bunch of proteins you make that survey the outside of your cells and the inside of your cells to see if there's anything infecting those cells, and then they send a warning out to everything. And I was looking at one particular protein and its interaction with how infections happen in the lung. And it turns out it's complicated.
Girl. Well, we're going to have to do another show about transgender animals and intersex animals and gender non-conforming animals. Yeah, because there's like fish that change their gender, crocodile eggs, dependent on the temperature.
That just clone themselves or something? Or they just kind of like reinvent themselves?
But I'm interested in the temperature.
Rotifers that are actually parthenogenic and they just continually reproduce themselves over and over again.
But the thing I'm most fascinated by is the temperature outside for some crocodile. Is it all of them? Crocodile species.
I think it's all crocodiles. Yeah.
Depending on the temperature outside, is their gender expression.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, I'm going to cook me up some croc cocks. Heat those eggs
up.
And
that's been Cooking with Mark.
Vincent, thank you so much for chatting with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Bye.
Always a pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Vincent Gabriel lives in San Jose, California. You can find him on Twitter at Vincent D. Gabriel. Just one L at the end for love or lesbians. Vincent's currently trying to get into grad school for science journalism, and we think he has a brilliant future.
He can do it for sure. I want to remind folks we can't do this podcast without your support. So if you're not a Plus member yet, consider signing up today at feastoffun.com/plus because your contribution to the show is what makes this show happen.
It's like our Patreon. If you believe in this podcast, you want to see more shows, make a contribution and access 12, almost 13 years now, right?
We're on our 13th year of podcasting.
13 years of amazing, one-of-a-kind, in-depth shows. You can learn a lot about LGBT culture, culture in general, and the people who make it, artists in society, and science.
Science, bitch.
That's right. Are you guys planning on going to the March for Science on Washington? Let us know. We want to talk to you. Do you think it's a good idea? What can people do to pressure politicians to make choices based on facts and stop seeing science as a partisan issue?
Facts and not alternative facts.
Yeah, alt everything.
In the library, they had a section that said, they had a sign that says alternative facts this way. And then underneath it said fiction.
Guys, thank you so much for listening to the show. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
Bye-bye.